Welcome to the Golden Age of Baseball with Eddie Robinson, baseball's oldest living player. Eddie was a four-time All-Star, World Series winner, scout, and front office executive during his amazing 65-year career in baseball. These podcasts will give the baseball enthusiast the opportunity to share a slice of baseball history with someone who actually lived it. And now, here's Eddie.
Well, we won from the get-go. Richard had helped some of those pitchers. He gave them a new pitch. It was called the slip pitch. And it was a new way of throwing a change of pace, kind of like you threw a curve, and you held it with a curve grip, and it came out of your hand like a curve, but you held it loosely in your fingers. And it kind of slipped out of your fingers. So you throwing it out, it kind of slipped out. And therefore was slower and fooled the hitters. It was a very successful pitch and really helped some of our pitchers. We started winning. We won 14 games in a row one year. And the newspaper started calling us the Go Go White Sox. Well, I wasn't one of the go-go boys. I didn't run very fast. But we had Jim Busby in center field, and he could run very fast. We had a little third baseman. I forget his name, but he could run fast. And early in the year, Frank Lane pulled off a big deal. It was the three-club deal. Philadelphia was involved, and Cleveland was involved, and the White Sox. And the White Sox sent Dave Philly and Gus Zernio, the big home run hitting outfielder we had, to Philadelphia. Philadelphia sent a left-hand pitcher, Lou Brissy, to the Cleveland Indians. And the Cleveland Indians sent Minnie Minoso to us in Chicago. Well, none of us had heard about Minnie, but we assumed that he was a very talented young player, hadn't played in the big leagues before. And he reported to us, and his first game was a night game. And Paul put him in the lineup and put him in, I don't think he played center, I think he played left field. He hit him third, and I was hitting fourth in the lineup. And the first time Minnie came up in White Sox uniform, he swung at the first pitch as hard as he could, and he let the bat go, and it whirled over my head, about 3 feet over my head. If it had been any lower, it would have killed me. But no harm was done. It went up in the stands, but luckily it didn't hurt anybody. I know it hit somebody, but it didn't hurt him. Minnie was just nervous because he never threw the bat after that. But when I hit by him, I was always on the alert for him to be throwing a bat. Well, Minnie, he really came on and helped the White Sox team. He was one of the go-go boys, could run like hell. He was a little bit short as an outfielder, but Paul worked on him, had him out for extra drills. And Minnie improved, and he got to be a good left fielder. He was a staple on the White Sox for years. I think he played 20 years. And I think then he came back. He worked for the White Sox after he was through as a player. And I think he played for them when he was 50 years old. They signed him to a contract, put him in a game, and he went to bat. I think he got a hit first or second time at bat. And anyway, Minnie was a great guy. And a fixture on our team. He was playing left field. Fences were 352 feet, and it was a brick wall to the stands in left field. And many drifted back on the ball one night, kept drifting back, and finally decided he's going to turn and run for it to catch it. And when he turned around, he was about 1 foot from the wall. And he ran face first into the left field wall, bloodied his nose, didn't break it, but bloodied it, and we had to call timeout, and I think halfway knocked him out. We had to bring him to. That was many, he just laughed it off. I remember another little story about Minnie, is that he crowded the plate. His stance was such that he really was close to the plate, and the pitchers knocked him down a lot. They did. I don't think they were throwing at him because he was black. I think they were throwing at him because he was close to the plate, and they wanted to move him back a little bit. Anyway, whatever it was, he came in the locker room one night, and he got a pint of milk out of the drink container, and he was just getting ready to get into the shower, and he had no clothes on, and he stood in the center of the locking room, and he poured that bottle of milk over his head, and he said, "I'm going to make myself white, and those guys won't throw at me as much." We all got a kick out of it. He was laughing about it and went on in the shower and washed the milk off. But there's a lot of stories about Minnie. And another story is that he wanted to buy a car. He wanted a Lincoln. He wanted some help. He wanted somebody to go with him and help him in the purchase of the car. And he asked Doc Kramer. And he and Doc were good friends, and they were joshing each other back and forth all the time, kidding each other. And he asked Doc if Doc would go with him to purchase that Lincoln. And Doc said, "Sure, I'll go with you." So they got a ride out there to the automobile place, picked out a really nice black Lincoln, and Minnie went in to sign the papers and make a deal for the car. And Doc got in the back seat. And when Minnie came out, Doc's sitting in the back seat. And Minnie said, "Aren't you going to ride in the front seat for him with me?" He said, "No, you're my chauffeur." He said, "I'm going to ride in the back." And so Minnie drove back to the ballpark with Doc in the back seat. The next day at the ball, when we were at the park, Minnie came in. He had a chauffeur's cap on. And, of course, we knew immediately what it was. He said, "If I'm going to have to chauffeur for Kramer, I'm going to have a cap to make me look like a chauffeur." Everybody got a big kick out of it. Those kind of things went on in baseball all the time. It's Doc Kramer one time. He was the first base coach for Richards. He and Jimmy Dykes, who was the manager of the Philadelphia Athletics, had been on a team together and had been buddy buddies and knew each other very well. But Kramer took 4 eggs with him out to first base coaching box. Al Lopez was in the dugout of the Cleveland dugout. Kramer started throwing those eggs at him. He threw all 4 eggs at Lopez in the dugout. And I don't think he might have hit him with one of them, but they hit and splattered all over the place, and everybody got a big charge out of that. I guess you're crazy. You think we're crazy doing these things, but that kind of livened up a little bit. It was the atmosphere in the ballpark in those days was nothing like it is today. Paul Richards, throughout the 1951 season, continued to be the kind of manager that I thought he would be, and he wasn't one to cheer you or jump up and applaud when you did something good. He sat on the end of the dugout, and as you came to the dugout, he'd give you a pat on the behind. If you got a pat on the behind from Richards, you figured you'd done pretty damn good, and everybody liked that. He didn't show off at all. He was a very quiet individual. He had his coaching staff, Lumen Harris and Jimmy Adair and Doc Kramer. And Ray Barry was the bullpen catching coach and pitching coach in the bullpen. Paul was his own pitching coach. That was a good coaching staff. We led the league in 1951 for half the season. In fact, we were into the second half of the season. We went into Yankee Stadium, and we had about a two-game lead over them. And I think we went in there for a four-game series. We lost the series to them. They won 3-4. Put us out of first place, and we never got back into first place. We didn't play as well the second half, and the Yankees played better, and they went on and won the pennant. And that was in the midst of their 5 pennants in a row seasons. They had very good teams and played very sound baseball. Well, we played sound baseball, but we just did not have quite as good a team. But nevertheless, we had a successful year. And I had made the All-Star team again in 1951. That was nice that I did that. The season ended, and I went back to Baltimore and put on a different cap and started running the restaurant again. I didn't really run it. Gil Hooper ran it, but I was there. It probably looked like I was running it. It had become quite popular. Eddie Robinson's Gorsuch House Restaurant. As I told you before, all the football players ate there, and the baseball players during the baseball season. Johnny Unitas, the golden arm quarterback of the Baltimore Colts. He was a regular. Jim Mutchler, who had graduated from Notre Dame and was a outstanding tight end for the Baltimore Colts. And Gina Marchetti and Lenny Thomas. Artie Donovan came in. And there I got to be very friendly with all of them. Artie Donovan, funny story about him. He bought a house and was having a swimming pool put in. He was out inspecting the swimming pool and got down in the deep end of it and couldn't get out. He was so big and heavy and he couldn't crawl out of the swimming pool. So they had to get a block and tackle, put it down in there for him, and lift him out of his swimming pool. But Artie was a wonderful guy. His father had been a famous boxing referee, and he was a little guy, but Artie was huge, and he was a defensive lineman for the Colts on their championship teams when Johnny Unitas. Baltimore got Johnny Unitas off the sand lots in Cincinnati. They needed a quarterback badly. And Webb Eubanks was the coach of the team. And I guess they had heard about this semi-pro quarterback who's playing in Cincinnati. And they talked to him, and he agreed to play, and they signed him. And he came to Baltimore and was a sensation. He was a sensation. He and Raymond Berry were quite a team. Raymond played left end, and Mutchler played right end. And Unitas and Berry had such great timing that they could move the ball down the field, him throwing to Berry and Berry stepping out of bounds. It was just very wonderful to see how they could do it. Well, I was very proud because Raymond Berry was the son of the Parrish High School football coach. His father was named Raymond Berry, and Raymond had graduated from Parrish High School several years after I had. His father came to coach at Parrish High School in 1949, The year I graduated in 48, he came there in 49 and won a couple of state titles and was the high school coach there for 25 years. I just wish I had been able to play for him. It would have been wonderful. Anyway, Raymond and I were very good friends, and he was an absolute regular at the restaurant, and we remained friends throughout his career. I had a couple of funny incidents happen there. I should have told you the first year I took over. The first day I had the restaurant, I was in there greeting people and having a good time. And this Irish priest, I think it was Catholic priest, came in with two other gentlemen, and they sat in the booth at lunch. It was lunchtime. And after lunch, the priest said that he ordered some Irish mist whiskey. Well, I'd never heard of Irish mist whiskey. The waitress had never heard of Irish mist. And we searched the bar, and we didn't have any. And I was embarrassed and apologized to the priest, told him, Father, the next time you come in here, I guarantee you we'll have Irish mist for you. And he was very happy about that and polite and said, don't worry about it, just so you'll have it next time I come in. Well, the next day I got the liquor distributor, and I told him I needed a bottle of Irish mist whiskey. And he promptly got it to me. I told him I needed it in a hurry, and he got it to me. When we sold the restaurant, I guess 7-8 years later, that bottle of Irish whiskey was still on the bar and had never been opened. So the Irish priest never came back. We never sold a drop of Irish mist whiskey. And another thing, that happened in the daytime. And in the nighttime, this friend of mine came in with his wife and another couple. They had a nice dinner. And the wife of his friend went to the restroom. When she locked the door when she went in, when she went to unlock the door, it would not unlock. And she could not get it to unlock. And she yelled, and somebody heard her, and then all of a sudden we were all trying to figure out a way to get the door open to get her out. And we got the key that was supposed to work on it and open it even if it was locked on the inside. And that didn't work. And finally, we had to take a hammer and hammer the hinges off the door to get her out. That was a very embarrassing situation, of course, that was happening within sight of the restaurant. And all of our customers were watching us knock the hinges off the door to get in to get that lady out. We were passing cigarettes under the door to her, assuring her it took a long time. She sat in there a long time. But those are two incidents that happened in the restaurant. And I could see that the restaurant was not big enough. It was, as I say, it seated. We had a nice bar. It seated 12 people, 12 bar stools. It was really a pretty little place, but it was little. And there was an alley next door to it. And then there was a row house on the other side of the alley, which I had bought along with the restaurant. I got Hooper had owned the house, and then the city owns the alley and the restaurant. And I bought the house and the alley and the restaurant. Couldn't do anything with the alley because the other businesses exited onto the alley. And you had to have all their agreement from all of them in order to close it. Well, I knew that the only way I could expand at all was to close the alley. So I started a process of getting the other owners of properties that exited the back of their business, exited on the alley. And there are about three of them, if they signed off, said that they agreed to my closing the alley, then I could close the alley and build into it and double the size of my restaurant. So I put that in, I hired the best, I had the best lawyer I knew, who was, he was the head lawyer for the Oriole baseball team. I hired their firm to go about getting the signatures that were needed to get the alley closed. That's kind of a long story. It went on for over a year. I'll tell you how it came out in 1953. It was not a very pleasant ending.
Thank you for listening to the Golden Age of Baseball with baseball legend Eddie Robinson. If you have a question for Eddie or would like to suggest a topic for him to discuss, please email eddie.robinson65@yahoo.com. And for an even deeper dive into the Golden Age of Baseball, read his autobiography, Lucky Me, My 65 Years in Baseball, which you can find on goodreads.com and on Amazon. The executive producer of the Golden Age of Baseball is Greg Ricks. Our engineer is Mark Robinson, and our podcast coordinator is Abby Robinson. Thank you.